Sometimes God confronts him with the devil and the spirits in order to convince him of their existence. From the top of heaven, he also sends the angels, his servants. Thus these beings appear to us, not in order to stay among us or become allied to us, but in order for us to become able to understand them. These apparitions are scarce, to tell the truth. But why should it be otherwise? Is it not enough for one of us to see an angel, in order for all of us to believe in the other angels? Paracelsus was probably born in 1491, and in the very same year Fascius Cardan recorded his observation of 7 strange visitors directly clatked to the creatures of the elements who were so puzzling to the great philosopher. The incident is preserved in the writings of his son, Jerome Cardan, 1501-1576, who is well known to us today as a mathematician. Jerome Cardan lived in Milan and was not only a mathematician but also an oculist and a physician. In his book De Subtilitate, Cardan explains that he had often heard his father tell the particular story and finally searched for his record of the event, which read as follows: August 13, 1491. When I had completed the customary rites, at about the 20th hour of the day, 7 men duly appeared to me clothed in silken garments, resembling Greek togas, and wearing, as it were, shining shoes. The undergarments beneath their glistening and ruddy breastplates seemed to be wrought of crimson and were of extraordinary glory and beauty. Nevertheless, all were not dressed in this fashion, but only 2 who seemed to be of nobler rank than the others. The taller of them, who was of ruddy complexion, was attended by 2 companions, and the second, who was fairer and of shorter stature, by 3. Thus in all there were 7. He left no record as to whether their heads were covered. They were about 40 years of age, but they did not appear to be above 30. When asked who they were, they said that they were men composed, as it were, of air, and subject to birth and death. It was true that their lives were much longer than ours, and might even reach to 300 years duration. Questioned on the immortality of our soul, they affirmed that nothing survives which is peculiar to the individual. When my father asked them why they did not reveal treasures to men if they knew where they were, they answered that it was forbidden by a peculiar law under the heaviest penalties for anyone to communicate this knowledge to men. They remained with my father for over 3 hours. But when he questioned them as to the cause of the universe, they were not agreed. The tallest of them denied that God had made the world from eternity. On the contrary, the other added that God created it from moment to moment, so that should he desist for an instant the world would perish. Be this fact or fable, so it stands. 10 Nearly 3 centuries later, in September, 1768, a young man of 16 was traveling to the University of Leipzig, with 2 passengers from Frankfurt. Most of the journey was accomplished in the rain, and the coach sometimes had trouble moving uphill. On one occasion, when the passengers had left their seats to walk behind the horses, the young man noticed a strange luminous object at ground level. All at once, in a ravine on the right-hand side of the way, I saw a sort of amphitheater, wonderfully illuminated. In a funnel-shaped space there were innumerable little lights gleaming, ranged step fashion over one another, and they shone so brilliantly that the eye was dazzled. But what still more confused the sight was that they did not keep still, but jumped about here and there, as well downwards from above as vice versa, and in every direction. The greater part of them, however, remained stationary, and beamed on. It was only with the greatest reluctance that I suffered myself to be called away from the spectacle, which I could have wished to examine more closely. The postillion, when questioned, said that he knew nothing about such a phenomenon, but that there was in the neighborhood an old stone quarry, the excavation of which was filled with water. Now, whether this was a pandemonium of will-o'-the-wisps, or a company of luminous creatures, I will not decide. The young man in question was Goethe. You will find this citing in the 6th book of his autobiography. According to Kenneth Anger, to whom I am indebted for this very interesting discovery, would the German poet and scientist have had occasion to learn more about the luminous creatures had he lived in the 20th century? If Paracelsus came back, would he find new material for his theories on the nature of the strange and fugitive races of beings from the sky? We can safely hypothesize that their attention would be immediately directed to the files of UFO landings. In the next paragraphs, we shall examine some of the recent cases they might have found of interest. What do they prove? Nothing. They only indicate that, if there ever was a time for scientists to bow their heads with awe before the variety and power of natural phenomena and human imagination, it is to be found in our own age of technology and rational thought, not in the confusion of medieval philosophies. Return of the Humanoids. One night in January, 1958, a lady whose name I am not authorized to publish was driving along the New York State Thruway in the vicinity of Niagara Falls, in the midst of a violent snowstorm. The exact time was 1:30 a.m. The lady was going to visit her son, then in the army, and she was driving very carefully, trying to find an exit, for she believed the thruway was closed ahead of her. Visibility was extremely bad. Hence she had no chance to think when she suddenly saw what seemed to be an airplane wreck on the center parkway. A large shape was visible, and a slim rod at least 50 feet high was illuminated and getting shorter as though it were sinking into the ground. My motor slowed down and as I came closer my car stopped completely. I became panicky and tried desperately to start it as I had no lights. My first thought was to get out and see what was happening, but I suddenly saw two shapes rising around that slim pole which was still growing shorter. They were suspended but moving about it. ILC seemed to be like animals with four legs and a tail but two front feelers under the head, like arms. Then, before I could even see, things disappeared and the shape rose, and I then realized it was a saucer. It spun and zoomed about 10 feet off the ground and up into the air, and I could not even see where it went. My lights suddenly came on. I started the car and it was all right. I pulled up to that place, got out with a flashlight and walked over to where it had been sitting. A large hole was melted in the snow about a foot across and grass was showing on it. The grass was warm, but nothing was dug up around there. The lady, who met only with disbelief when she told her story to her family, reported the case in a letter to Otto Binder when his syndicated series Our Space Age began to appear in a number of newspapers. The most puzzling element in this account is not so much what is described but the fact that such stories have become, since 1946, rather common in all parts of the world. To a physicist, of course, they appear unbelievable, just as the strange mannequin met by Street Antony would appear unbelievable to a biologist. And yet there are several cases on record in which similar accounts are associated with traces that can hardly be questioned. In the celebrated incident at Socorro, New Mexico, it was a policeman, Lonnie Zamora, who reported seeing two small beings, dressed in white, close to a shiny egg-shaped object, which rested on four pads before it took off with a thunderous noise, only to become perfectly silent as it flew away. The incident took place on April 24, 1964, and was the occasion for some interesting measurements by local police officials and a Federal Bureau of Investigation man of the traces left by the object, and of some even more interesting deductions by William T. Powers on the possible mechanical construction of the landing gear. Here again we observe an emotional pattern strangely reminiscent of the medieval scene just surveyed. The witness in the Socorro case, when he was about to be interviewed by Air Force investigators, was so little convinced that he had observed a device of human construction that he asked to second the priest before releasing his report to the authorities. Then, of course, there is the report of the Kentucky family who claimed to have been besieged by several little men, whose appearance was completely fantastic. The incident occurred on the night of April 21, 1955, and was the occasion of many strange observations of the behavior of the visitors. One of the creatures was seen approaching the farmhouse with both hands raised. When it was about 20 feet away, two of the witnesses shot at the intruder. It did a flip and was lost in the darkness. Then it appeared at the window when the men came back inside the house and was again shot at. Another creature, seen on the roof, was knocked over by a bullet, but instead of falling, it floated to the ground. The entities had oversized heads, almost perfectly round, and very long arms, terminating in huge hands armed with talons. They wore a sort of glowing aluminium suit, which is reminiscent of the sylphs of 1491. Their eyes were very large and apparently very sensitive. They always approached the house from the darkest corner. The eyes had no pupils and no eyelids. The eyes were much larger than human eyes and set on the side of the head. The creatures generally walked upright, but when shot at, they would run on all fours with extreme rapidity, and their arms seemed to provide most of the propulsion. On September 10, 1954, in Quarrebelle, a small French village near the Belgian border, at about 10:30 p.m., Marius de Wilder stepped outside and was at once intrigued by a dark mass on the railroad tracks. De Wilder then heard footsteps in the night. Turning on his light, he found himself facing two beings wearing very large helmets and what seemed to be heavy diving suits. They had broad shoulders, but de Wilder did not see their arms. They were less than 4 feet tall. De Wilder moved toward them with the intention of intercepting them, but a light appeared on the side of the dark object on the tracks, and de Wilder found he could not make a single move. When he regained control of his body, the two visitors had attacked the supposed machine and flown away. This classic observation had a strange sequel, never before published. French civilian investigators who studied the case were cooperating closely with local police officials, but there were other people on the site, notably representatives of the Air Police from Paris. When an inquiry was made regarding the analyses performed on some stones found calcined at the spot where the saucer had been seen by de Wilder, it was discovered that even there, police could not obtain information as to the results of the analyses. In the words of the local police chief, the official body working in liaison with the Air Police belongs to the Ministry of National Defense. The very name of this ministry excludes the idea of any communication. On November 19, 1954, the following facts came to light. The police confirmed that Wilder had made a second report concerning an observation of an object in the vicinity of his home. We were later to learn that the report in fact described a landing. However, the police said de Wilder and his family have decided, for fear of adverse publicity, to take no one in their confidence regarding this second occurrence. Therefore you will find no mention of it in local newspapers. Furthermore, civilian investigators were told, politely but in no uncertain terms, that any further information on such incidents would be kept confidential by the police. Reports continued, however, and some of them would have delighted Paracelsus. On October 14, 1954, a miner named Starovsky claimed to have met, on a country road near Urchin, also in the north of France, a strange being of small height and bulky figure with large slanted eyes and a fur-covered body. The midget, less than 4 feet tall, had a large head and wore a brown skullcap, which formed a fillet a few inches above the eyes. The eyes protruded, with very small irises, the nose was flat, the lips were thick and red. A minor detail, the witness did not claim he had seen the creature emerge from a flying saucer or enter it. He just happened to meet the strange being, who did not wear any kind of respiratory device. Before he could think of stopping him, the creature had disappeared. 6 days later, on October 20, 1954, in Paravicino d'Urba, near Como, Italy, a man had just put his car in the garage when he saw a strange being, covered with a luminous suit, about 4 feet tall, standing near a tree. When he saw the motorist, the creature aimed a beam from some sort of flashlight at him, paralyzing the witness until a motion he made when clenching the fist holding the garage keys seemed to free him. He rushed to attack the stranger, who rose from the ground and fled with a soft whirring sound. The author of this unbelievable story was 37 years old and was known locally as a trustworthy man. He arrived home in a state of great shock and went to bed with a high fever. The details of the case were obtained through an investigation by the Italian police. 11 years later, the files of landing reports and strange creatures associated with them had become very thick indeed. Then a new flurry of reports began. On July 1, 1965, Maurice Mass, a French farmer who lived in Valenzelk, had the following experience. As he arrived in his field, at 6 a.m., and was getting ready to start his tractor, he heard an unusual noise. Stepping into the open, he saw a machine that had landed in his lavender field. He thought it must be some sort of prototype and walked toward it, with a mind to tell the pilots, in no uncertain words, to go find mother landing spot for their contraption. It was only when he was within 20 feet of the machine that he came in full view of the scene and realized his mistake. The object was egg-shaped, had a round cockpit, was supported by 6 thin legs and a central pivot, and was not bigger than a car. In front, appearing to examine a lavender plant, were the 2 pilots. They were dressed in one-piece, grey-greenish suits. On the left side of their belts was a small container, a larger one was on the right side. They were less than 4 feet tall and had human eaves, but their heads were very large, about 3 times the volume of a human head. They had practically no mouth, only a very small opening, without lips. They wore no respiratory device, no headgear, and no gloves. They had small, normal hands. When Mass came upon them, they seemed to become suddenly aware of his existence, and yet it was without any indication of fear or surprise that one of the pilots took a small tube from its container and pointed it at Mass, with the result that the witness found himself suddenly incapable of movement. For the next 60 seconds or so, the 2 entities looked at Mass. They appeared to be exchanging their impressions vocally in a sort of gargle. These sounds came from their throats, insisted the witness, but the mouths did not move. The eyes, in the meantime, conveyed human expressions. In private, Mass told a civilian investigator that he had not been frightened by their attitude, and that it contained more friendly curiosity than hostility toward him. After some time, estimated by Mass, as I have said, as about 1 minute, the creatures went inside the craft. The door closed like the front part of a wooden file cabinet, but Mass could see them through the cockpit. They were facing him as the object took off in the opposite direction, first hovering a few feet from the ground, then rising obliquely with the takeoff speed of a jet plane. When it was about 60 yards away, it vanished. The witness was closely questioned on this last point by French scientists who were privately interested by the case. But Mass insisted he could not say whether the object went away so fast that the eye could not follow it or whether it actually disappeared. He made it quite clear, however, that one moment, the thing was there, and the next moment, it was not there anymore. Mass remained alone in his field, paralyzed. The word paralysis is not properly used in connection with incidents of this type. Mass said that he remained conscious during the whole observation. His physiological functions, respiration, heartbeat, were not hampered. But he could not move. Then he became very frightened indeed. Alone in his field, unable even to call for help, Mass thought he was going to die. It was only after about 20 minutes that he gradually regained voluntary control of his muscles and was able to go home. There is a sequel to his experience. For several weeks after the incident, Mass was overcome with drowsiness, and all his relatives, as well as the investigators, observed that he needed so much sleep that he found it difficult to stay awake even for 4 hours at a time. This is another little known characteristic of close proximity cases. To Mass, who was used to working from sunup to sundown as the early hour of his observation itself shows, this was a very impressive and disturbing consequence of his experience. Another result of the publicity the case attracted was the great damage to Mass's field, as crowds of tourists gathered to seconds the traces left by the craft. At this point, I should say that Mass is a man respected in the community, a former resistance fighter, a conscientious and successful farmer. He is regarded as absolutely trustworthy by the police authorities who investigated the case under the direction of Captain Valcht, of DIN. Yet this man tells us a story that does not simply appear fanciful, it is completely unbelievable. What is Mass's impression of the visitors? For some reason, Lai says, he knows they meant no harm. They were not hostile to him, only indifferent. As he stood facing them, during that long minute, he suddenly was overcome with a certitude that they were good, a belief he is unable to rationalize, because at no point did he understand their strange language. The story is fantastic. Yet it reminds us of the account Barney and Betty Hill gave under hypnosis of their alleged abduction in New Hampshire. The account involved the same description of an alien language, of entities whose expressions were almost human, of an overwhelming feeling of confidence, and of not the slightest indication that the incident had a meaningful purpose or followed an intelligent pattern. Of considerable interest to the psychologist is the fact that the entities are endowed with the same fugitiveness and behave with the same ignorance of logical or physical laws as the reflection of a dream, the monsters of our nightmares, the unpredictable witches of our childhood. Yet their craft do leave deep indentations in the ground, according to observers who were fully awake and absolutely competent at the time of the sighting. What docs it all mean? How can one reconcile these apparently contradictory facts? Some, in a laudable attempt, question the classical search for patterns. Is it necessarily true, they ask, that we would detect meaningful patterns, in the same sense of our own intelligence level, in the behavior of a superior race? Is it not much more likely that we would find in their actions only random data and incoherent pictures, much as a dog would if confronted with a mathematician writing on a blackboard? If so, it is only after new concepts have emerged in our consciousness that our vision of the world would be suddenly illuminated and that we would truly discover the meaning of their presence in our environment. And, if our superior race does in fact generate what we are now observing as the UFO phenomenon, is it not precisely with the purpose of changing the course of human destiny by presenting us with evidence of our limitations in the technical, as well as the mental, realm? This theory, which has been presented in particular by the French science writer Aimé Michel in several brilliant books and articles, is perhaps the most intriguing that has been put forward to date. It does not attempt, however, to answer the question of the nature of the objects. Children of the unknown, if they are not real, should we see these rumors as a sign that something in human imagination has changed, bringing into a new light uncharted areas of our collective unconscious? They may be only children of our fancy, and our love for them akin to our love for Batman and Cinderella. But they may be real. Modern science rules over a narrow universe, one particular variation on an infinite theme. In any case, it is important to understand what need these images fulfill, why this knowledge is both so exciting and so distressing to us. Such is the subject of this book. Parr spoke to Magonia precisely with the purpose of changing the course of human destiny by presenting us with evidence of our limitations in the technical, as well as the mental, realm. This theory, which has been presented in particular by the French science writer Aimé Michel in several brilliant books and articles, is perhaps the most intriguing that has been put forward to date. It does not attempt, however, to answer the question of the nature of the objects. Children of the unknown, if they are not real, should we see these rumors as a sign that something in human imagination has changed, bringing into a new light uncharted areas of our collective unconscious? They may be only children of our fancy, and our love for them akin to our love for Batman and Cinderella, but they may be real. Modern science rules over a narrow universe, one particular variation on an infinite theme. In any case, it is important to understand what need these images fulfill, why this knowledge is both so exciting and so distressing to us. Such is the subject of this book. Chapter 2, The Good People. Man's imagination, like every known power, works by fixed laws, the existence and operation of which it is possible to trace, and it works upon the same material, the external universe, the mental and moral constitution of man and his social relations. Hence, diverse as may seem at first sight the results among the cultured Europeans and the debased Hottentots, the philosophical Hindus and the Red Indians of the Far West, they present on a close examination features absolutely identical. Edwin S. Hartland, The Science of Fairy Tales, An Inquiry into Fairy Mythology. It was an unusual day for the Food and Drug Laboratory of the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, when the Air Force requested an analysis of a piece of wheat cake that had been cooked aboard a flying saucer. The human being who had obtained the cake was Joe Simonton, a 60-year-old chicken farmer who lived alone in a small house in the vicinity of Eagle River, Wisconsin. He was given three cakes, ate one of them, and thought it tasted like cardboard. The Air Force put it more scientifically, the cake was composed of hydrogenated fat, starch, buckwheat hulls, soya bean hulls, wheat bran. Bacteria and radiation readings were normal for this material. Chemical, infrared and other destructive type tests were run on this material. The Food and Drug Laboratory of the U.S. Department of Health, Education and Welfare concluded that the material was an ordinary pancake of terrestrial origin. Where did it come from? The reader will have to decide for himself what he chooses to believe after reading this second chapter. It begins with the Eagle River incident because this is a first-hand account, given by a man of absolute sincerity. Speaking for the U.S. Air Force, Dr. Alan Hunk, who investigated the case along with Major Robert Friend and an officer from Sawyer Air Force Base, stated, "There is no question that Mr. Simonton felt that his contact had been a real experience." The time was approximately 11 a.m. on April 18, 1961, when Joe Simonton was attracted outside by a peculiar noise similar to knobby tires on a wet pavement. Stepping into his yard, he faced a silvery saucer-shaped object brighter than chrome, which appeared to be hovering close to the ground without actually touching it. The object was about 12 feet high and 30 feet in diameter. A hatch opened about 5 feet from the ground, and Simonton saw three men inside the machine. One of them was dressed in a black two-piece suit. The occupants were about 5 feet in height. Smooth-shaven, they appeared to resemble Italians. They had dark hair and skin and wore outfits with turtleneck tops and knit helmets. One of the men held up a jug apparently made of the same material as the saucer. His motions to Joe Simonton seemed to indicate that he needed water. Simonton took the jug, went inside the house, and filled it. As he returned, he saw that one of the men inside the saucer was frying food on a flameless grill of some sort. The interior of the ship was black, the color of wrought iron. Simonton, who could sense several instrument panels, heard a slow whining sound, similar to the hum of a generator. When he made a motion indicating he was interested in the food that was being prepared, one of the men, who was also dressed in black but with a narrow red trim along the trousers, handed him three cookies, about 3 inches in diameter and perforated with small holes. The whole affair had lasted about 5 minutes. Finally, the man closest to the witness attached a kind of belt to a hook in his clothing and closed the hatch in such a way that Simonton could scarcely detect its outline. Then the object rose about 20 feet from the ground before taking off straight south, causing a blast of air that bowed some nearby pine trees. Along the edge of the saucer, the witness recalls, were exhaust pipes 6 or 7 inches in diameter. The hatch was about 6 feet high and 30 inches wide, and although the object has always been described as a saucer, its shape was that of two inverted bowls. When two deputies sent by Sheriff Schroeder, who had known Simonton for 14 years, arrived on the scene, they could not find any corroborative evidence. The sheriff affirmed that the witness obviously believed the truth of what he was saying and talked very sensibly about the incident. Food from Fairyland. The Eagle River case has never been solved. The Air Force believes that Joe Simonton, who lived alone, had a sudden dream while he was awake and inserted his dream into the continuum of events around him of which he was conscious. I understand several psychologists in Dayton, Ohio, are quite satisfied with this explanation, and so are most serious amateur ufologists. Alas! Ufology, like psychology, has become such a narrow field of specialization that the experts have no time left for general culture. They are so busy rationalizing the dreams of other people that they themselves do not dream anymore, nor do they read fairy tales.